Hello, Trade Talks listeners. Now, you may not have missed me, but I have definitely missed you. And this is to let you know that I have a new podcast called The Economics Show with Sameya Keynes. Our friends at Trade Talks have kindly allowed me to share our launch episode. So have a listen and then subscribe to The Economics Show with Sameya Keynes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And here's the show. US government debt is high, and it's getting higher. That seems like a problem, and one that neither political party seems about to fix. On this week's show, we're going to ask, has the US finally borrowed too much? This is The Economics Show with Sameya Keynes. Today, we are going to talk about the debt. Here are some numbers. The US debt to GDP ratio is over 100% of GDP. The Congressional Budget Office thinks the deficit is headed to 6% of GDP, and a lot of that is just the debt interest. Those numbers sound pretty scary. Are they? With me to discuss is the economist Jason Furman. Jason is the former chair of the Council of Economic Advisers and current corrupter of Harvard University students' minds as he teaches them economics. Jason, hello!
Hello! Never gotten that intro before.
Well, do you want to give a better description of what you're up to right now?
You know, it is interesting. On the issue of the deficit itself, I, before teaching about fiscal sustainability, surveyed my students and asked them how worried they were about the deficit. And I phrased the question in exactly the same way that the question had been phrased to a survey of the American Economic Association. And it turned out my students were actually more worried about the deficit than professional economists, but less worried about the deficit than the public as a whole. And, you know, I think maybe I move them towards where economists are, which you could decide whether or not that is corruption by the end of our conversation.
Okay. So from that, I'm going to take that you're teaching students and also generating data for your economic experiments. Okay, so let us translate those survey results into numbers that we can understand. So on a scale of 1 to 5, this is going to be very scientific, how worried are you about the US fiscal position? So 1 is it soothes me to sleep, I'm very relaxed, and 5 is every night I wake up in a cold sweat. I don't want the detailed explanation, I just want the number.
I change my mind an awful lot, sort of as the market goes up and down, my mood goes up and down. Today I'm at a 3.
Oh, 3? That's rubbish.
I know. It's not interesting. I'm sorry.
Where were you yesterday?
But I've gone up. I was at like sort of a 1 or a 2 for a while, and I've been making my way up towards 5.
Okay, fine. So you're getting more worried. Okay, so that leads me on to my next question, which is how we got here. Take us through how the US got to the fiscal position it's currently in.
Yeah. So the debt is the stock of all the deficits we've ever run in the 200 plus year history of our country. It is about 100% of GDP, if you exclude the debt the government owes to itself. That's roughly where France and the UK are. That's below where Italy and Japan are. It's a lot higher than I could have imagined possible if you had asked me 10 or 20 years ago, but I actually think it's completely fine. And if it stabilizes there or even stabilizes above that, I would have not the slightest worry in the world. Where the United States is quite unusual right now is not the amount of debt it has accumulated, but the amount of debt it is accumulating, which is to say our deficit, which is how much we're adding each year, is unusually very, very large. Using the IMF numbers, which are standardized, last year the United States was at 8.8% of GDP, its deficit. The European euro area was at 3.5% of GDP. Moreover, that nearly 9% of GDP deficit that we had based on the IMF numbers last year was in a year where the unemployment rate was about 3.5%, where the economy was growing at about a 3% rate, where basically everything was going just about as well as you could imagine. And no, it wasn't just because of interest rates, because even if you exclude interest payments and look at what's called the primary deficit, it was also unusually large. So the position we're in now is that our debt is on the high side, but not terrible. the pace at which we're accumulating it and adding to it is way above everyone else.
Okay, so the US government is borrowing a lot, but why? Is it that there's profligacy from the administration, kind of spending huge amounts on industrial policy, what have you? Is it something to do with tax cuts?
Yeah, so if you look over a longer period of time, we've had a number of tax cuts, each of which ratcheted down revenue. Basically, Republicans come in and cut taxes for 100% of people. Then Democrats come in, preserve the tax cuts, and often expand them for the bottom 99%, and then partially, but not fully, reverse them for the top 1%. And then Republicans come in and do another round of that. And so taxes have basically been on a downward ratchet for a number of decades now. But certainly part of the deficit this past year was temporarily elevated spending because a lot of things in the industrial policy, the Inflation Reduction Act, were front-loaded. They saved money sort of 5 or 10 years from now, but a lot of the spending goes out up front.
Okay, so you've got both lower taxes and higher spending. Can we move on now to just reasons why it is okay to borrow, right? I mean, you started by saying that you had previously been at a one in terms of being very, very relaxed about the US government's fiscal position. Can you walk us through some good reasons to borrow?
Yeah. So first of all, you know, a lot of people talk about leaving debt to our grandchildren. I confess, I'm just not worried about that. Our grandchildren are going to be like riding around in flying cars and, you know, AI is going to do all their homework for them. Their lives are going to be great. And so I'm more worried about the people who are alive today, who are probably the poorest generation that there will be for the rest of humanity. Second, in some cases, debt can be used to invest and grow the economy and make you richer in the future. Now, it depends a lot on what you're borrowing for. And I think some of the borrowing we're doing now fits that definition. I think other borrowing we're doing now does not fit that definition. And then finally, an economy does need a certain amount of demand. And 5 years ago, it seemed like with even really low interest rates, we could not sufficiently support economic growth and demand with a very low budget deficit. Now that's less of an issue, but it's possible that it's still lurking in the background.
Okay, well, I'm sure all of the youth today feeling grumpy on the internet will be reassured to hear that in a few decades they'll all be on flying cars. But okay, those are the good reasons to borrow, but there are limits somewhere, right? I mean, you can't just borrow an infinite amount today and say, oh, it's fine because future generations will benefit. How do you think about the constraints to borrowing today?
Yes, we're literally on an unsustainable course. Debt is rising and rising and rising as a share of GDP, unless we get super lucky with something like productivity growth, which I wouldn't count on. When you sit down to write an economic model to predict the future of the economy, you literally can't solve that model unless it satisfies something called a no Ponzi game condition. That if the government is engaged in what economists call the equivalent of a Ponzi scheme, that just at some point, there aren't enough people to borrow from. You can't roll over the debt and things can't continue. So that's the easy thing to understand. The hard thing to understand is where that threshold is and what the costs of getting close to that threshold are.
Okay, but before we talk about the threshold, can we just talk a bit about how you measure the fiscal stance? I mean, you said you were relaxed about the debt, but more worried about the deficit. But, you know, the scary numbers that people seem to be bandying around include the debt to GDP ratio. Is that meaningless? And what would be more meaningful?
Yeah. So our debt is 100% of GDP. That sounds like, wow, we need to use all of our income to pay that our debt. That doesn't leave anything left for anything else, except we don't need to pay our debt off in a single year. In fact, we don't ever need to pay our debt off. We can keep rolling our debt over as long as we're not letting it get too large relative to the economy. And if we amortized our debt over, say, an infinite horizon, then we're talking more about sort of very, very small payments that you would need to satisfy it. You know, interest rates are a really critical part of all of this. And this is a lot of why my mind keeps changing about the debt, because I'm much more worried about debt service. And in particular, I'm worried about debt service after inflation, because every year you inflate away part of your debt, you want to subtract that from your concerns. And 5 years ago, when interest rates were really low, that gave us a lot of room to borrow. Interest rates have risen a lot, and a really important and uncertain question right now is, are they going to fall back to something like they fell back to before? And that's roughly what the Fed seems to think in its projections. Or are they going to stay high where they are right now? And the difference between those matters an awful lot for how worried we should be about the future.
Okay, so just to make that concrete, what is your favorite measure of fiscal sustainability?
Yeah, so one, I'd like to see the debt constant as a share of GDP, but that doesn't answer the question of whether it's constant at 50% of GDP or 500% of GDP. So the next thing I would look at is how much the real debt service is as a share of GDP, and I'd like to see that number be below 2% and stable. That's something you've seen in the United States and a lot of countries before, is roughly consistent with the fiscal system being really decent. So if our debt stabilizes and it leaves us with real debt service less than 2% of GDP, you know, I'd be at a 1 on your nervousness scale.
Okay, but just to really spell out that real debt service as a share of GDP, that's interest payments as a share of GDP, but subtracting off a factor that accounts for the fact that inflation has eroded some of the real value of debt?
Yeah, exactly. So just to use round numbers, suppose your debt to GDP is 100% and interest rates are 5%, then you're paying 5% of GDP in interest. But if you had 2% inflation, you're also inflating away 2% of your debt. And so really what you should be worried about is the 3% of GDP in real debt service above and beyond what's just compensation for the erosion of the debt for inflation. So in that situation, I would say real debt service as a share of GDP was 3%. And if it was 3% and projected to stay there, I would be quite worried.
And what is that real debt service as a share of GDP now?
If you believe the Congressional Budget Office forecasts, right now it's something close to about 0.5% of GDP, but it's rising to about 1.5% of GDP over the next decade. The problem is that the Congressional Budget Office, which is nonpartisan and excellent, may also be overly optimistic. It thinks interest rates are going to come back down pretty sharply. It, by law, has to assume that a bunch of tax cuts expire in 2025. It doesn't think we're going to continue funding emergencies around the world or increasing our defense spending, et cetera. So I'd think of it as, if everything goes right, we're going to be at 1.5% of GDP. If anything goes wrong, we'll be above the 2% of GDP threshold for me to be nervous.
Okay, well, that doesn't sound very reassuring at all. I wonder you're at a 3, but okay. Can we talk a bit about some of the conversation around this? I mean, we saw a warning a little while ago from Phil Swagel, who's the head of the Congressional Budget Office. He was warning that there was a risk of a kind of Liz Truss-style sudden market reaction. I mean, he did say that the US wasn't there yet, but how nervous do you feel about that kind of sudden switch in the markets?
I'm nervous about that, and I'd take insurance out against it. The fact is, people have been talking about that for decades, and it keeps not happening. So I'm not sure how much insurance I would pay, but I'd pay some to avoid it. Part of what I think happened with Liz Truss is an advantage and a disadvantage of the UK system, which is when she proposed a budget, the expectation was that that budget would actually happen. And so if she proposed something scary and deficit increasing, people thought, whoa, this is going to happen, and markets got nervous. Here, if President Biden went out, and he has not done this, but he proposed a huge deficit increasing budget, everyone would know Joe Manchin or the Republicans or someone else would stop it. And so the fact that things are hard to get done in our system means it probably will be hard for us to pass some law that's a huge step function up in deficit. But conversely, it also makes it hard to pass a law that's a step function down in deficit. So our conservatism, I think, protects us against some of the wild gyrations, but is going to make it harder to solve the underlying problem eventually.
What do you make of concern that the U.S. disproportionately funds itself through short-term borrowing? It seems to be a bit of an outlier among rich countries in terms of the share of its debt that it's borrowing short-term.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, I was pulling my hair out. You could borrow long-term at 2%. You could lock that in. If your concern was interest rate risk from deficits, you could solve that by borrowing long-term. At this point, you know, all the interest rates are high, so it's become a little bit less obvious. But still, I'd rather us lock in 4.5% 10-year rates than take the risk that, you know, contrary to people's expectations, but well within reality, short-term rates rise even higher. So part of what you're trying to do is immunize yourself against future interest rate risks. Yeah, we should be continuing to shift to long-term borrowing.
Okay, so that short-term borrowing creates a vulnerability in some sense?
Yeah, which is if interest rates spike up, it doesn't matter for your 10-year debt. It does matter for any new short-term debt that you are issuing. If you're an emerging market, you'd worry quite a lot. Could you actually have successful auctions week after week after week to roll over your debt? I'm not worried about that for the United States, but I'm worried at the price at which you could borrow. People will only lend you money if you're willing to pay 5.5%, 6%, 7% interest. And so the way to take out insurance against future fiscal risks is partly by cutting your deficit, but also partially by shifting to more long-term borrowing, which is more stable and predictable, albeit not super attractive pricing at the current moment.
So just thinking generally about the costs of this high borrowing, one is that we're storing up the risks of some kind of crisis whereby interest rates suddenly shoot up. Another one that you hear a lot about in theory, and I wonder if you tell your students about this, is the effect of high government borrowing on investment, right? So there's been this long-term fear that it would crowd out investment. That wasn't really an issue over the 2010s. Do you think that's more of an issue now, potentially?
I think we are seeing crowd out as we speak. There's been, for example, a huge increase in investment in manufacturing structures in the United States. And that's because that investment has been subsidized. And when you subsidize something, you get more of it. But interest rates have gone up and the cost of construction has gone up. So you look at every other type of structure, transportation, warehouses, et cetera, they're all down and below where they were at the end of 2019. And so we're in a situation right now where the government, by subsidizing some things, is getting more of those things, but at the expense of higher interest rates and thus at the expense of other things. So absolutely, I think we are getting on net the same or less investment, even with all of this support for industrial policy. And you know, in the future, that means we'll have a greener economy, I hope. We'll have a safer and more resilient economy, I hope. I don't think it means we'll have a larger economy.
Over the past few years, there's been a lot of discussion of various different macro theories, different ways of thinking about borrowing and the government's role in the economy. Could you just summarize what you think MMT, modern monetary theory, was saying?
Yeah, modern monetary theory keeps changing exactly what it means, but most of it is rejecting the notion of trade-offs, rejecting that we should be concerned about fiscal sustainability, and arguing for a much more ambitious, unbounded agenda for government spending.
Okay, well then I guess the next question is, what do you think we've learned about that from the past few years?
I think we've learned that it's really more of a political movement than it is a coherent, testable economic theory. It's made various predictions and statements, and when those get falsified, everything changes around again.
What's an example?
For example, the constraint on fiscal policy is inflation. But then inflation emerged, and the argument was, oh, the inflation is not fiscal and shouldn't be solved with fiscal means. Or that there's no crowd out. Interest rates don't rise when deficit spending goes up, but interest rates have risen a lot as deficit spending goes up. And I think fundamentally, the problem is that MMT claims to be a timeless truth. It's applicable to all countries and all times. And it just doesn't apply to Argentina and Turkey. And it also doesn't apply to the United States in the year 2024.
Before we cut to a break, I just have one more question about, you know, assessments of the U.S. fiscal stance, which is credit rating agencies. We've seen some high-profile downgradings of the U.S.'s position. What should we make of those?
Look, the credit rating agencies don't know anything that a well-informed investor or economist doesn't already know. So they have no information. When S&P downgraded, the markets didn't care at all. When Fitch downgraded, I poo-pooed them and said, what do they know? Turned out that looked like maybe it was a bit of a focal point event where it wasn't new information, but it allowed people to step back, take stock, reevaluate. And you did see long-term interest rates rise by about a percentage point after that Fitch downgrade. So I do think those downgrades maybe matter more than I used to think they mattered. And, you know, is the United States going to pay its debt? Of course it's going to. We are always going to pay our debt. But part of what they're warning about is political dysfunction in Washington. And, you know, if you pay back your debt after a big bout of inflation, you're not quite paying back as much. And so it's not totally crazy, the concerns they're raising.
Okay, well, we should cut to a break. But when we get back, I am going to ask you more about those focal points and how you would get the debt down. We are back. The big question, what do you think is necessary to get onto a more sustainable track? What kind of reduction in borrowing is needed?
So as an economist, I can say that I would like to see, you know, either spending cut or revenue raised, that it should be done in a way that stabilizes the debt so that interest payments are manageable. And in order to do all of that, based on the Congressional Budget Office's optimistic forecast, we would need to make a fiscal adjustment of about 2% of GDP. If you're more pessimistic, that fiscal adjustment might need to be about 5% of GDP.
Wait, hang on. 5% of GDP sounds like a lot. Could you put that in historical context?
Yeah. So 2% of GDP is something that's really manageable. And we know it's manageable because that is what was done in 1990 by George Bush and the Democrats sitting together at Andrews Air Force Base, hashing out an agreement. In 1993, the Democrats on their own under President Clinton did a deficit plan of about 1.5% of GDP. So that lower range of my estimate is one that we've done before, and I do think we could do again if we needed to. 5% of GDP is well beyond anything the United States has ever done. And that's a little bit harder to figure out, frankly, how it would happen. Although economically, it's completely possible. The issue is politically.
Okay, so let's put Jason Furman in charge of a united House and Senate. What would you do to get borrowing down?
Well, here's where you have to combine my positive views about how the economy functions, which says we need this 2 to 5% of GDP in deficit reduction, with my normative views about what type of society and country I'd like to have. There's a lot of things I'd like more of. I'd like more investments in children. I would like more paid leave. And so for me, I would do most of the adjustment in the United States on the tax side. That would also bring us more closely in alignment with where the rest of the world is. So then it becomes the question of how to raise taxes, partly in a fair manner, which is disproportionately raising them on the rich, But even if you went as far as you could possibly go on the rich, there's just not enough money there to do what I'd like to do for society and also stabilize the debt. And so we're going to have broader taxes.
Okay, well, that sounds like not a vote winner. Do you think there are any politically feasible ways of getting closer to that point?
Look, the problem we have right now, if we talk about what's feasible, it's impossible we're going to raise taxes on the bottom 99% of Americans. It's impossible we're going to have substantial spending cuts outside of a very narrow slice of the budget, the so-called non-defense discretionary spending that has education, research, and all that stuff in it. It's also impossible that our debt is going to continue indefinitely on the course it's on. And a fourth thing is impossible, which is it's impossible that everything I just told you is true. So something's going to have to give. And I don't quite know what's going to give and when it's going to give. And, you know, broadly speaking, I see two types of forcing events. One could be things get much worse economically. This happened in Canada in the early 1990s. Interest rates spiked. They got really nervous about the fiscal situation and they sat down and they fixed it, and things that were impossible became possible. So an economic forcing event. But the second thing is a political forcing event. And that could be the insolvency of Social Security, the pension fund for older people and people with disabilities, or Medicare. So I'd love it to be a political forcing event that leads us to address that. That's a whole lot better than an economic forcing event. But one way or the other, I think one of those will make impossible things possible.
How are you thinking about the expiration of the Trump administration's individual tax cuts that are coming in 2025? How is that going to interact with this issue?
So that, unfortunately, is just downside risk. All the official forecasts assume that these tax cuts go away at the end of 2025. And there's President Biden would like to continue roughly two-thirds of them for families below 400,000. President Trump wants to continue all of them. And then there's a lot of members of Congress who want to go above and beyond those tax cuts to do even more by, for example, letting people fully deduct their state and local taxes or something like that. And so for me, there is some opportunity in that expiration to maybe have a wonderful tax reform and additional revenue. I think, unfortunately, there's much more peril than there is opportunity. It could be a forcing event for, you know, more tax cuts layered on top of what we already have.
Okay, so I think when I started this conversation, I was maybe a 3, and I think you've pulled me up to a 4 in terms of my anxiety. Is that what you intended, or not really?
No, I think people do need to pay attention to this issue. And at the least, do no harm. So when I see, you know, an additional $500 billion of spending here, an additional $500 billion there, unless that spending's really, really good, it's just, why are you making this problem worse and digging this hole deeper? But I do think there's not like an immediate urgency to solving it. If you told me that we are going to get around to this 7 years from now, and the debt will stabilize at 125 or even 150% of GDP, I'd be back at a 1. And so we don't need to undo the debt we have already, and we don't need to act instantly. And that's part of what makes me calmer. The problem is, if you're always calm, it's almost going to be like create a self-fulfilling problem. So in some ways, I'd rather have somebody make a self-unfulfilling prophecy, where they're like, we're all doomed. And then everyone can mock them when doom doesn't come. But actually, they'd be the reason that doom doesn't come. So I think we need more doom mongers. But I, for whatever reason, I have a hard time being one myself.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, listening to you talk about the calm version of the outlook, I did feel very stressed. So if there is a role for a doom monger going, then sign me up. I think that is a good note to end things on. Jason, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
That is all for this week. You have been listening to The Economics Show with Sameha Keynes. This episode was produced by Edith Russolo, with original music from Breen Turner.
It is edited by Bryant Urstadt. Our executive producer is Manuela Zaragoza. Cheryl Brumley is the FT's global head of audio. I'm Sameha Keynes. Thanks for listening.